From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Genocide, immunity, and amnesty. As London's High Court rules that former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet has diplomatic immunity, a look at how he and other former heads of state could get away with murder. And in South Africa, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission faces legal challenges as it seeks to release its final report. And we take an in-depth look at the war in Colombia. All that and more on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to Democracy Now! Amy Goodman is away today. First, the headlines from Jeremy Scahill.
This news from London. Britain's High Court yesterday rejected two arrest warrants from a Spanish magistrate seeking the extradition of former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet to face charges of murder, torture, and kidnapping during his 17-year rule. The court ruled that the Chilean general is immune from criminal prosecution in Britain because the alleged crimes occurred while he was supposedly head of state. But the court did rule that the former dictator must remain in custody pending an appeal by prosecutors. The court also ordered the British government to repay Pinochet's legal costs, estimated at $500,000. Many human rights activists are calling the court's ruling a violation of international law and the Nuremberg principles, saying that Pinochet's arrest and prosecution should be the first of many present and former so-called government officials to stand trial for crimes against humanity. Activists point to people such as Henry Kissinger, George Bush, and Bill Clinton, who they say have committed crimes against humanity while hiding behind the veil of, quote, official duty. More on this later in the show. And this news from Washington. Almost 10 years after Congress found the Federal Housing Agency under President Ronald Reagan to be replete with waste, fraud, and abuse, two independent counsels have concluded their investigation, which led to the convictions of 16 people. In a report sent this week to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, the counsel said their 8.5-year effort had found a, quote, pervasive pattern of criminal behavior involving officials at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, as well as consultants and others who did business with the department. While the events occurred in the council's voluminous report ended in 1989, the reverberations echoed into the Clinton administration under Henry Cisneros as housing secretary and the current secretary, Andrew Cuomo. And this news from Brazil. The Brazilian government introduced a three-year, $80 billion package of spending cuts and tax increases yesterday, including austerity measures requested by the International Monetary Fund. As part of the cuts, which will directly affect large sections of the country's social service programs, states and municipalities will be forced to limit spending. In a television address earlier this week aimed at selling the austerity measures to the country, Brazil's finance minister said, quote, "The time for gradualism is over." And this news also from Washington. Attorney General Janet Reno yesterday called the murder of a New York doctor targeted by anti-abortion activists intolerable and pledged to track down and bring the killer to justice. In a meeting with representatives of groups concerned about women's health clinic violence, Reno also promised that federal enforcement would vigorously defend, quote, constitutionally protected rights to provide and obtain reproductive services. This news from Havana. President Fidel Castro has confirmed Cuba is holding in prison a second man from El Salvador accused of planning terrorist activities to destabilize the island nation. In comments broadcast late last night, Castro said Otto René Rodríguez was arrested June 10th bringing explosives through Havana's international airport after a flight from Guatemala and would be tried shortly. Castro also said that Rodríguez was sent by self-confessed Cuban exile commando Luis Posada Carriles, who in turn has had close links with the CIA and the FBI throughout a long career of plotting against Cuba. This news from Virginia. A white Virginia man went on trial yesterday on capital murder charges stemming from the burning and beheading of a black man last year. Emmett Kressel faces a possible death sentence if convicted of the brutal murder of Garnett Johnson, a 40-year-old former U.S. Marine set on fire during a party at the trailer home of a third man who pleaded guilty in the case. Hundreds of students protested outside Indonesia's parliament today in the second straight day of anti-government demonstrations demanding that the dictator B.J. Habibie step down. The protest at the legislature came one day after 8,000 students gathered there in the biggest rally in the capital since student-led demonstrations forced former dictator Suharto to step down in May. Also today, 30 women protested on Jakarta's main street against violence against women that they claim has been state-sponsored. A spokeswoman for the group said rape had been used to intimidate women in East Timor and Aceh, where residents have been fighting for independence from Indonesia. In this news from San Cristobal de las Casas, Mexico, Mexico's Zapatista rebels yesterday denounced recent military movements in Chiapas state and suggested they might be an attempt by the government to prevent renewed talks between the rebels and a congressional peace commission. In a communique issued by Zapatista subcomandante Marcos, the rebels criticized what they said were increasing military operations after a simulated army invasion of a meeting center in their Lacandon jungle bastion La Realidad on Tuesday. Marcos said the Air Force had been staging day and night flyovers of La Realidad and that a column of 40 tanks, armored cars, and troop transporters pushed into the area Tuesday. Some soldiers had taken photographs and video footage of the rebels' meeting place. And that's some of the news at this hour. Back to Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is away today. Britain's High Court ruled yesterday that former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet is protected from arrest by diplomatic immunity, thus quashing two international arrest warrants issued by a Spanish judge, Baltasar Garzón, this past October 16th. The decision stunned many international scholars because the British judges accepted Pinochet's argument that former heads of state cannot be arrested and tried for actions undertaken while in office. While Pinochet will remain in custody, awaiting a final decision by the House of Lords next week, human rights groups voiced their alarm that the case could establish a dangerous precedent. Even former rulers, they argue, are not above international humanitarian law and must be brought to justice if they commit crimes against humanity. Meanwhile, the Spanish High Court meets today to decide whether Spain has jurisdiction to try Pinochet for genocide. Judge Garzón, who issued the international arrest warrants against Pinochet, said yesterday that he will continue to seek the former dictator's extradition as long as he remains in custody. While Chilean victims' rights and exile groups reacted with disappointment and frustration, the decision was cheered by Chile's right wing, Britain's Conservative Party, and the Peruvian president and inventor of the self-coup, Alberto Fujimori. With us this morning to discuss this latest development is Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Michael, your immediate reaction to what's happened in Britain?
Well, Juan, it was just an outrageous decision. It's a decision that has absolutely not a shred of legal precedent. The court, and we can go into that, was totally wrong about the so-called former head of state immunity. And it also sends a terrible message for the future going forward. I mean, what's the court saying? That you can't indict Pol Pot? That you can't indict Hitler? That the U.S., even though I didn't agree with what they did, couldn't take Noriega out of Panama? I mean, the decision has absolutely no legal basis.
What do you think were the pressures or the battles that must have raged, certainly within the British government and among, must have had some impact on this judicial decision?
Well, it was obviously a totally political decision. The first reason I know it's political is because the law that the court cited is law from basically before the Second World War and law from the last century. Nuremberg, which was the prosecution of the German, the Nazis after the Second World War, Nuremberg basically said explicitly that heads of state or former heads of state have no immunity for crimes against humanity. That's been the law from then forward. At the Center for Constitutional Rights, we sued Marcos, head of the Philippines, no immunity, the United States court held, particularly for former officials. You might want to make an argument about current officials. I don't think there's a very good one. But for former officials, you have no argument. Marcos, allowed suit in the United States. Prosper Avril, former dictator of Haiti, allowed suit in the United States. So the court basically set back the cause of justice and of prosecuting serious human rights violators by at least 50 or 100 years. Now, why did they do that? Well, it's obviously totally political why they did that. First of all, as Margaret Thatcher herself came out and said, I don't think he ought to be extradited to Spain. This is the former head of state who has tea with Pinochet, you know, when he comes to London, saying that not only is it a terrible statement in terms of human rights law, but it's directly interfering in the court process. This was their ally during the Falklands Malvinas War. They obviously didn't want to get him. I think the other thing you have to understand here, countries, whether it's Britain or the United States, they don't like this kind of justice. This is really a kind of people's justice where individual people go to prosecutors and under the special laws in Europe can begin these prosecutions. This guy, Pinochet, you have to remember, he's partly our product. We put him into office to overthrow Allende. The British supported him. So they don't want to get him. This was one of the guys who carried out the dirty work to so-called stop an alleged socialist government, the Allende government, a socialist government in Chile.
Now, what is the appeals process in Britain? As I understand it, it has to go to a panel of the House of Lords. How is the House of Lords the area of appeals here?
Well, that's the way Britain works. This was the highest court in Britain, and the last appeal, much like when you appeal from a death sentence in the Caribbean, it goes to some special little Queen's Privy Council. This goes to the House of Lords. The House of Lords, as I'm sure most of our listeners know, is a house of made up of people who've inherited their titles and a few other people who are appointed. But basically, it's made up of inherited people. It obviously represents the most conservative traditions in Britain. It's the kind of thing even this guy who announced a decision is Lord something. These are people who hark back to Britain of the 1890s. And what he said was interesting. The Lord who actually rendered this decision said, "This to allow Pinochet to be arrested in this case and tried would be one nation interfering with what's happening in another nation." Now, that has just completely been changed in the last 50 years. What the rule used to be that a country couldn't tell another country what couldn't get it for what it was doing with the citizens of its own country, couldn't prosecute if someone tortured its citizens. It was no other country's business. But since the Second World War, it's been decided that these serious international human rights violations like torture, disappearances, slavery, those people are enemies of all mankind, is what the law says. And one country is concerned by what happens in another country, just like the United States should have been concerned by what happened in Rwanda or should have been concerned by what happened in other countries. So should Britain and every country be concerned what happened in Chile. So what you got here is a bunch of lords who come out of like probably the age of British imperialism saying to one of the people that they obviously and other countries supported, "We're not going to try him. This is another country's business. It's not our business." That would set back not only justice in the Pinochet case, set back the cause of human rights probably to the last century.
We're talking with Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights about yesterday's stunning decision by a British court that would allow the release of former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet because of diplomatic immunity that the court ruled that he enjoyed. But I'd like to ask you, Michael, in terms of the Spanish judge who initiated this whole process, clearly even in Spain he's a controversial figure. Could you tell us a little bit about the history of his battle against this the disappeared and the murders in Latin America?
Well, first of all, that judge, let's understand this, didn't reach out on his own for this case. Cases are assigned in Spain by lottery. So it went to a judge who's a legitimate judge. I mean, the guy's a good judge. He started going after these cases, getting very little support from the Spanish government. Chile's a major trading partner of the Spanish government. They have a conservative government in office. They deal with Chile all of the time. This judge, really a real maverick, getting tremendous support, I think, from groups like Amnesty International, from my office, from all over the world, really, to really push on these cases. Now, he first started on cases having to do with Spanish citizens. Unlike the law in the United States, in Europe, if there's a Spanish or a French citizen or a Swedish citizen or a Swiss citizen killed overseas, the criminal courts of the home country have jurisdiction to prosecute those cases. So this judge was completely, utterly, 100% legitimate in going after those prosecutions. What's amazing now is the chief judicial officer of Spain is saying he doesn't have authority in trying to get him out of office. Complete interference with his job. It's as if Attorney General Janet Reno basically said to a federal judge here, I don't want you to hear that case. I don't want you to issue the warrant for Mr. X, Y, or Z to come here. Complete, utter judicial interference shouldn't be allowed. This judge is a pioneering judge, a real hero, but he also just took the law to its logical conclusion, as we've built up human rights laws over 50 years and said that these people are international criminals. They're enemies of all mankind. They can be tried anywhere. This judge really just applied the law. But what's happening now is the countries who sign all these treaties, the torture convention and everything else, they don't like the law when it's actually applied to them. They only want to apply it to minor little countries that the United States or England or Spain doesn't like.
And what's going to be the implication in terms of other nations? Certainly the United States has insisted that crimes committed against Americans anywhere in the world, our government can then seek to attempt to prosecute those who commit them. Even, obviously, as you mentioned, Noriega was in power at the time. If anybody had diplomatic immunity, it was a person who was in power at the time. And we execute a search warrant with several thousand American soldiers, bring him back to face a federal judge on a drug indictment in this country. Will the British decision have any impact on other countries, or are there some other countries that are already clearly establishing a more progressive policy in terms of going after former dictators who commit genocide?
Well, you know, Juan, this is really, there's no way to look at this except as a major setback. The logical conclusion of the work that human rights advocates and people have been doing for many, many years is the arrest and prosecution of someone like Pinochet. Other countries have now asked for the extradition of Pinochet. France has three citizens, French citizens who were killed in Chile. Sweden has one, and Switzerland has one. They've all, in the process of or have made extradition requests to England. But, of course, England, with its basically retrograde laws that really just show you that the imperialism is still left in England, if they uphold this court decision in the House of Lords, they will uphold the decision to let Pinochet go back and not face justice in those three countries. Now, as I said, as you asked me about the House of Lords a moment ago, it's not tried by the entire House of Lords. It's tried by a special panel appointed by the House of Lords, but they're all lords.
Right. And in terms of the United States, there was some indication the United States was ready to supply documents on Pinochet from its own files if requested by England. At the same time, this has had an impact in terms of at least raising once again this whole issue of what happened in Chile and what was who was involved, what governments were involved in the horrible disappearances and executions that occurred during the Pinochet era. What impact has this had on the movement here in this country?
Well, we'll see the day when the U.S. opens its files on Pinochet and gives them to England. Already, there has been a request for over the last year from Garcon, the Spanish judge, to the United States for documents. What the United States has given the judge, they claim, we've given them, the State Department got up in front of the TV and said, we've given them hundreds of documents. They've given them all public documents that you and I can go to any reading room and get a hold of. That's not what the Spanish judge wants, and that's not what the United States is giving the Spanish judge. So the U.S. is holding key evidence here, key evidence obviously that might very well implicate the United States in the coup in 1973. It's certainly everybody's aware that the U.S. was funding the opposition in Chile and was doing everything they could to get rid of Allende. So those documents are very embarrassing to the United States. And it parallels, really, what's happened with the prosecutions in Haiti as well. In Haiti, the United States went in and picked up 160,000 pages of documents from the right-wing organization FRAP, is now holding on to them. The Haitian government has requested them for purposes of prosecution in Haiti. The U.S. is holding them. Again, because these things are not neutral. The United States, whether it's Haiti or whether it's Chile, had its claws really deeply into those coups and into the terror. And I think that's what we're seeing, and that's also what we're seeing as a reason why Pinochet is not right now being extradited to Spain. Because, as I said, basically, he was the water boy for these guys. That's what he was.
And, of course, we also have a constant right here in the United States, and the Haitian government has still attempting to bring him to justice, isn't it?
No, that's correct. The Haitian government has an extradition request. He's under a final order of deportation from the United States. The State Department said he was responsible for the terror in Haiti. And despite that, the United States is letting him walk free on the streets of Queens. This is a guy who has terrorized and who has the ability to continue to terrorize Haitians here and abroad. And the question is, the United States has been conspicuously quiet about Pinochet. I haven't seen any public statements from major figures saying this guy should be extradited back to Spain. We had 35 congresspeople write to the United States saying, to the government saying, liberate the documents, send them over to Spain. But it's been very quiet, and for very good reason, obviously.
Well, thank you, Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and we'll continue to follow the Pinochet story as we see what happens both in Spain and with the House of Lords next week. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Welcome back to Democracy Now! This is Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is away today. As the South Africa Truth Commission sets out today to release its long-awaited report on human rights violations during the apartheid era, a flurry of last-minute legal appeals by former South African President F.W. de Klerk have succeeded in removing key sections of the report until he has had a chance to review the allegations. The Truth Commission reluctantly agreed yesterday to cut portions on de Klerk from the document that implicated the former South African president in human rights violations committed under his rule. In response, the African National Congress has launched an urgent legal action late yesterday to block damning allegations against it that have been made in the report. We have with us two guests today to discuss the release of the report. One is Helen Sussman, former Member of Parliament for the Democratic Party, an anti-apartheid activist for 36 years. She is skeptical about the Truth Commission process and the granting of amnesty to gross human rights violators. She joins us by telephone from Johannesburg. And we have also Janet Cherry, a researcher for the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission from April of 96 to July of this year. She is currently a professor of sociology at the University of Port Elizabeth, also a former political prisoner when she was fighting apartheid as a member of the United Democratic Front and the ANC. Welcome to both of you, and welcome to Democracy Now! I'd like to start with Janet Cherry. What is your immediate reaction or assessment to the report and to President de Klerk's last-minute legal challenges?
As you know, the report was released this morning. It was handed over to President Mandela. And I think with a lot of relief by Archbishop Tutu and other members of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, my own feeling is that the last-minute attempt by F.W. de Klerk and by the ANC to prevent the release of the report or aspects of the report is in some way a good reflection on the work of the commission, because if the commission is coming out with findings which are unfavorable to all sides in the conflict, then I think it's done its job well, because the reality of the conflict in South Africa was that the main protagonists in the liberation struggle and in the apartheid state were responsible for gross violations of human rights. And that has to be reflected in the Truth Commission's report. And I think the fact that they are unhappy with aspects of the report shows that this has been done.
Now, in terms of the report also delivers a stinging verdict on the former wife of President Mandela, Winnie Madikizela Mandela, and holds her accountable for a reign of terror inflicted on the Soweto township in the 1980s. I'd like to ask Helen Sussman her reaction in particular to that aspect of it and also to the general report.
Well, I haven't seen the report, so Janet would talk with much better knowledge than I do. But I do agree with her that the fact that both the ANC and both ex-President de Klerk have objected to parts of the report does show that there was an even-handedness in writing the report. So until I actually see the report, I really can't comment much further. As for the allegations against Winnie, I think it was pretty well known that Winnie was running a pretty tough, heavy-handed campaign with her football club. But Winnie, I'm possibly one of the few people in South Africa who's got a favorable word to say about Winnie, because I happen to know what she went through all those years, not only having Mandela, who was then her husband, in jail for 27 years and leaving her to bring up the kids alone, but she was harassed mercilessly by the special branch of the police. She was detained over and over again. On occasion, her house was burned down. I mean, she really went through a bad time. And I saw her being changed from a sympathetic, caring person who was really a social worker into an embittered and somewhat vicious person. And she was fighting a war. To her, anybody who was suspected of being an informer, which would lead to one of the comrades being taken away, detained and tortured and probably murdered, to her was sufficient cause to blot them out. It was really a ruthless war she was waging.
Well, Helen Sussman, you have been critical of the entire process of granting amnesty to human rights violators. Could you explain a little about why you feel this way and what alternative would have been possible for Mandela's government?
Well, prosecution, of course, would have been possible. I mean, I just don't like the idea of people who've committed really heinous crimes being allowed to say we did it for a political purpose and then just getting away with it. I mean, one thing about Winnie, she hasn't even asked for amnesty. She's prepared to take her medicine. And I don't see why these people who have murdered and tortured people should simply be able to say we did it. Our senior officers told us to do it, and it was a political motive, and just get away with it. I'm not one of these nice turn-the-other-cheek type of people, you see. I've got a very strong retributive streak in me.
And Janet Cherry, your response to Ms. Sussman?
Well, my response is that the amnesty clause in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was partly the result of a political compromise between the two major protagonists in South Africa. But it's more than that. It's also one way of getting to truths which we might not otherwise have been able to obtain. And in a way, I think what's happened is that we've traded justice for truth. And as a historian, I think there is an argument in favor of doing that. We'll have to see what the response is to the report from the general public, I think, in order to try and work out whether it has been worthwhile. But I think we have to accept that we've given up the possibility of justice being administered in some cases, and it's very hard for some people to accept that. But we have also gained knowledge about what happened, which I don't think we would have got. I think there are cases such as the Craddock 4, the Pebco 3, where the security police involved would not have applied for amnesty or would not have revealed information if they hadn't been able to apply for amnesty. They had closed ranks. They had kept that information very, very quiet over a long period of time, and there was no sign that they would have come forward with that information if we hadn't been offering amnesty.
What about the agreement of the commission to withhold its findings on de Klerk? Is that being seen by, in some quarters, as special treatment for him that that others named in the report are not receiving, Ms. Cherry?
Look, I'm sure that there are people in some quarters who would see it in that way. I don't see it that way. I see it more as a legal technicality, and I think it's a pity. It's a pity because it would be nice if the TRC could be perceived to be completely even-handed, and I can understand with people within the ANC who see that we have dealt with F.W. de Klerk in one way and with the ANC in
another way. But I think it was a time factor, wasn't it, Janet, that the commission said in its statement to the court that they felt the ANC had had enough time to study what, in fact, was being held against them, whereas de Klerk had not been able to.
Yes, I think that is true. I think it was a legal point, really.
Yes, I don't think it's a question of even-handedness. I think it's, you know, as you say, it's a question. It's a legal point.
Right. Well, I'd also like to ask about the second part of the commission's name, the Reconciliation Commission. I guess many international observers saw the model that had been agreed on in South Africa as possibly being applicable in other areas where there had been severe civil war and internal strife. Has there been, as a result of this process, any genuine reconciliation among the parties or that were involved in the long struggle against on either side of the apartheid issue, or have the revelations only resulted in even more bitterness? Janet Cherry?
Who do you ask?
Both of you. First, Janet Cherry.
Well, we don't want to speak together.
All right. My response to that is that I think reconciliation is a very difficult process to assist through an institution such as the commission. It's a process which is going to take a very long time. And there have been instances through the commission where reconciliation has happened, but I think there have probably been more instances where it hasn't happened. However, the bitterness of the truth that has come to light is something which in the long run is going to hopefully enable people to come to terms with their past. I'm not sure that reconciliation has happened yet at all, really.
And Helen Sussman?
Well, I mean, one has seen some fairly dramatic instances of reconciliation. The parents of Amy Beall, for instance, the young American girl who was killed by blacks in a township, the parents have forgiven the perpetrators, and there were some dramatic scenes, and there were a few others during the course of the TRC hearings. But by and large, I personally doubt whether it has had any widespread effect as far as reconciliation between the races or between the protagonists or between the perpetrators. I think the real value of the TRC, to my mind, is that it has, of course, resulted in revelations which very many people just didn't believe of incidents that had happened. Now, I was not one of those, you see. I was party to getting a fair amount of information behind the scenes. So none of it really came as a surprise to me. I mean, the Ribeiros and the McTingis and the Craddock people and all of that, I was pretty well aware there must be a third force at work. I never had any doubt about it. But a lot of people were, in fact, very skeptical about it. And perhaps the revelations at the TRC have opened their eyes to the horrors of what went on. That's really the best I can say about the TRC as far as I'm concerned.
And in terms of the attempt by the ANC to block some of the release of some of the conclusions, the Reuters is reporting that Desmond Tutu was devastated by the attempt to block publications. Will this in any way affect the image of the ANC in South Africa among the broad population? Janet Cherry?
Undoubtedly.
You're not allowed to say that. Keep dropping off.
Among the broader population. I personally was very surprised that the ANC had fought that last-minute challenge because the findings that the TRC made about the ANC's involvement in human rights violations contained no surprises, really. I mean, there were things that the ANC had told the Truth Commission themselves. So it really is quite strange that the ANC should act in a manner when they are presented with the findings.
And Helen Sussman, what's your...
Well, you'd have to repeat that question. Every second word was blotted out. I didn't hear it.
I'm sorry. The connection must be bad.
Connection is bad.
Yes. I asked whether I mentioned that Bishop Tutu was devastated by the reaction of the ANC in attempting to block portions of the report being released. Do you think that those actions by the ANC would lead to some loss of its image in the broad population, or why do you think that they reacted in that way?
Well, no, I don't really think so, because I think, you know, the ANC has more or less persuaded itself and its followers that their fight, their struggle was one for justice, whereas the apartheid struggle, of course, was one manifestly unjust. And I think that's really how they have presented themselves. And to some extent, the Amnesty Commission really went along with that by giving a sort of blanket amnesty. I think it was to 27 people, the leaders, at the beginning or sometime during the hearings. You know, people view it in a different sense. I suppose, in a way, my war was just and your war is unjust. And I don't think you'll have anybody changing their minds.
And where does the country go from here in terms of an enormous amount of time and public energy? Obviously, has been spent in this in coming up with this report. How does the country now, several years into its democratic process? What are the main problems that it faces in terms of being able to progress as a multiracial society? I'd like to ask first Helen Sussman and then Janet Cherry.
Yeah, well, I really consider it economic, basically. I mean, the fact is that we have a very high unemployment rate, something like 33%, especially among black people. And, I mean, the promises, pre-election promises, which were always rather ambitious, I thought, made by the ANC before the last election have just simply not been realized. I mean, there are still millions of people living in squatter camps and under very bad circumstances. To my mind, I mean, really the thing we've got to get on with is to get growth in the economy, to be able to provide jobs for people, to be able to build houses for people. That, to my mind, is the major, major problem.
And Janet Cherry?
Well, I must agree with Helen Sussman. I think it's undeniable that the major challenge facing us is the socioeconomic challenge. The work of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was one small part of the transition process. And I think that if the TRC has presented something which can be the starting point for a sense of all South Africans owning their history and acknowledging it with all its
and getting on with the job
and pain, then it will enable people to get on with the job. With a sense, I'm not arguing some sort of super nationalist consciousness, but just a sense of acknowledging the past and being able to let it go.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us today. Helen Sussman, former member of parliament for the Democratic Party and anti-apartheid activist for 36 years, and Janet Cherry, a researcher for the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission for 2 years and currently a professor of sociology at the University of Port Elizabeth. Thank you very much for being with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. We'll be right back. You're listening to Democracy Now. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is away today. President Clinton yesterday met with Colombia's new conservative president, Andrés Pastrana. At the top of their agenda, Colombia's drug trade and the Colombian peace process. While the Clinton administration has paid lip service to the second issue, it has pumped millions of dollars worth of military aid into the so-called war on drugs. Just this past month, Congress approved a $2.3 billion drug interdiction law that will increase military aid to Colombia despite its dismal human rights record. Violence in Colombia is reaching new heights. Paramilitary death squads linked to the Colombian military have conducted scores of massacres and emptied entire villages overnight. The Colombian military enjoys widespread immunity for gross human rights violations. Colombian guerrillas continue to kidnap civilians and to terrorize the population. Over 1 million civilians have been internally displaced. In a report released this month, Human Rights Watch documents violations of international humanitarian law by all of the parties involved in the conflict. But the human rights group faults the Colombian government in particular for its lack of will to investigate and punish military officers responsible for those violations. We now go to a recent speech by Human Rights Watch researcher on Colombia, Robin Kirk, who authored the most recent report on Colombia for that organization entitled War Without Quarter, Colombia and International Humanitarian Law. She spoke at the 11th National Conference of the Colombia Human Rights Network in Washington, D.C., and we're going to go now to sections of her speech.
For Colombians and in Colombia, violations of international humanitarian law are not abstract concepts. They're not just legal terms. They are the grim material of everyday life for many Colombians. War can burst into the daily activities of a farm, a village, a public bus, or a school with the speed of armed fighters arriving down a path or in four-wheel drive vehicles. Sometimes, armed men will carefully choose their victims from lists. Other times, they simply kill those nearby to spread fear. Indeed, a willingness to commit atrocities is among the most striking features of Colombia's war. I think this concept was first really made clear to me by a sociologist working in Colombia named Alejandro Reyes, but he talks about the atrocities that occur daily in Colombia as a kind of language. Instead of speaking to each other with words, the combatants in Colombia speak to each other through bodies, through massacres, through mutilations. And these mutilations, by and large, are done on the bodies not of other combatants, but of civilians. And by civilians, I mean people who take no direct part in the conflict, who do not take part in military hostilities at all. The inauguration of a new president and the growth of a broad-based movement that has called for a just and fair peace have given Colombians a new hope for an end to this kind of violence. Indeed, civilians lead the effort to convince the parties to respect the laws of war and negotiate an end to conflict. Some communities thrust into the conflict have attempted to negotiate local accords with combatants as a way of protecting their civilian populations. Nevertheless, none of the parties to the conflict, and I mean none, not the state, not the paramilitaries, and not the guerrillas, have actually fully respected the laws of war. Let me just give you one statistic to show you what I mean. Last year, in 1997, over 2,100 people who were not combatants, who were civilians, were killed by political violence in Colombia. In contrast, just a little over 1,000 combatants were killed. In other words, the casualties of Colombia's conflict are mostly civilians. They are not fighters. The fact that the laws of war are violated so systematically in Colombia, we believe at Human Rights Watch, is a major obstacle to any real and lasting peace. And we believe that respect for the laws of war has to be a necessary first step for all sides before peace negotiations can really begin in earnest. The laws of war are not negotiable. they are not to be put on the negotiating table. They have to be a precondition to any real talks and a show of good faith on the part of all sides that they are willing to sit down at the peace table and talk about the issues that concern them, but not do it while they are at the same time killing and massacring civilians. When I say laws of war, I want to be clear about what I mean in Colombia. The laws of war that we apply to Colombia are essentially three. It's Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions of 1949, which address armed confrontations between relatively organized armed forces or armed groups occurring exclusively within the territory of a particular state. We also apply Protocol 2, additional to the Geneva Conventions, which applies to non-international armed conflict where insurgent forces are highly organized, and Protocol 2 is meant to protect civilians and captured combatants from violence. In other words, as Carlos mentioned in his remarks, the point of the laws of war is not to condone or authorize certain war tactics, but fundamentally and as a priority to protect the lives of civilians or of combatants who are no longer in combat. And finally, we also use, in general, customary international law, which results from the general and consistent practice of states, followed by a sense of legal obligation. The Colombian government adopted the Geneva Conventions in 1963 and Protocol 2 in 1996. I wanted to explain to you why, in general, or use a couple of points to explain how the laws of war are different from a straight, more straight human rights approach to Colombia. Just to highlight a couple of points. If we take the definition of human rights as a technical definition, a legal definition, human rights really only apply to states, states who are responsible for protecting the rights of the people that live within them. For instance, the guerrillas are not subject to human rights law, since they are not states, since they have signed no treaties. But guerrillas are subject to the laws of war. When Protocol 2 was being negotiated in the 1970s, the negotiators included irregular groups like the PLO, like SWAPO, and several others. So they were very much a part of the negotiations that led to Protocol 2 and the basic rules that armed groups are supposed to follow in these kinds of situations. Secondly, human rights often does not deal with the kind of situations that we often find in a situation of war, kinds of attacks that can occur that don't necessarily come under any kind of human rights interpretation, but that do come under a laws of war interpretation. And finally, I want to point out what the laws of war do not do. They do not legitimize armed opposition groups. They do not give them any political status whatsoever. Secondly, I think I've mentioned this, they do not condone any tactics of war. There's no tactic of war that is approved by the laws of war. The laws of war are meant to protect civilians, not regulate what kind of tactics can be used in an armed situation. And finally, the laws of war do not condone any type of killings, whether it be of combatants or of civilians. In other words, if you kill someone who is a combatant, the laws of war do not say it's okay. Again, they are meant to protect civilians, civilian homes, et cetera, et cetera. In our research on this matter, in the research we've done over the past 2.5 years, we found that few of the combatants in Colombia, and I'm speaking in general of the groups involved, seriously question that the laws of war should apply to Colombia. No group questions the fact that Colombia satisfies the condition for the application of the laws of war. Yet the distance between words and deeds in Colombia is vast. All parties, as I said, actively manipulate the concept of international humanitarian law for perceived political gain and tactical gain. There's also deep disagreement about the terms used in the laws of war to identify non-combatants and military targets. While some of this disagreement may be the subject of honest debate, much of the opposition to the full compliance with the laws of war in Colombia is a cynical justification for continued, deliberate, and atrocious violations of the minimum standards necessary to protect human life. Let me go to some examples, just to put a little meat on the words. For instance, starting with the Colombian government, and specifically the security forces, the Colombian security forces will almost always characterize any and all guerrilla activities as violations of the laws of war in an apparent attempt to damage them in public opinion and gain sympathy. Yet the Colombian armed forces consistently fail to supply the evidence necessary to show how these actions violate the laws of war. And it's worse. Even as government accuses the guerrillas of violating the laws of war, their own officers, who are bound to uphold respect for the laws of war, have engaged in a consistent and systematic pattern of violating the laws of war in a variety of ways. Let me just mention two. One of the most prevalent ways that we see the laws of war violated by the Colombian army in particular is the extrajudicial execution of especially young men who they suspect of supporting the guerrillas. A second and perhaps more disturbing way that the Colombian government violates the laws of war is by its continued relationship with paramilitary groups, and especially the sharing of logistical information, intelligence, or simply just turning the other way and letting paramilitary groups operate without any trouble. One of the cases that we document in the report is the case of El Haro in Antioquia, which was the site of a paramilitary massacre at the end of last year. When we talked to victims of the massacre, people who had survived the massacre, we found that even as paramilitaries were in the village of El Haro conducting executions and torture and mutilating the bodies of their victims, the army was providing them with a perimeter on the outside to protect the paramilitaries from guerrilla attack. And people who tried to flee El Haro to get away were systematically turned back by the soldiers guarding the perimeter. In a similar vein, the Colombian guerrillas, and by this I mean the FARC, the ELN, and the EPL, have argued repeatedly that although they support humanitarian standards, they do not accept Protocol 2 since it was not negotiated directly with them. As I mentioned, in fact, Protocol 2 was negotiated with the participation of at least 11 insurgent groups at the time. That is no excuse not to abide by the laws of war. Let me just mention two cases that we feel are egregious violations of the laws of war by the guerrillas. In one case, again at the end of last year, in the village of San José de Apartado, which is in northern Antioquia, the FARC detained five members of the San José de Apartado community. And because the FARC claimed these five members of this community had failed to get the FARC's approval for declaring themselves a peace community, these five individuals were summarily executed on the outskirts of town. The ELN has gained a reputation for various kinds of abuses, but probably among the most egregious are its systematic executions of young girls who go on dates with soldiers. And this is something that's very common, especially in eastern Colombia in the oil-producing regions. When we brought this up directly with the ELN, we were told that indeed they confirmed that this had happened, that guerrillas had executed a series of 13, 14, and 15-year-old girls because they had acted as intelligence agents. In other words, they were providing soldiers with intelligence. When we pointed out that these girls were dating 17 and 18-year-old recruits, and it was a big stretch to think that they could provide any kind of intelligence whatsoever, the guerrillas claimed that they would get back to us with an explanation for their acts, which they actually have never done. Finally, for his part, the leader of the paramilitary alliance known as the AUC, or the United Self-Defense Groups of Colombia, the AUC, Carlos Castaño, has repeatedly stated a willingness in the press to pledge his forces to respect the laws of war, but he qualifies that support by claiming that Colombia needs a Creole version of international humanitarian law adapted to Colombia's irregular warfare and specifically allowing the execution of combatants, hors de combat, or in other words, combatants who have been wounded or have been disarmed and captured. Let me explain to you a little bit of Castaño's reasoning on what constitutes a combatant. When I spoke with him a couple years ago, I asked him about why his forces had been killing a series of butchers in the state of Córdoba in northern Colombia. And he said, well, very simple. What happens is the guerrillas will steal cattle. They'll steal a herd of, say, 100 head of cattle. And then they'll go to the farmers in the mountains, and they'll say to the farmers, you give us one of your cows, and we will give you 10. So the farmer is obligated to accept the 10 stolen cattle, and for those 10 stolen cattle, the guerrillas will get one clean cow. So it's instead of money laundering, this is cattle laundering, Colombian style. And then the guerrillas go to the local markets and they sell the cleaned cattle to the butchers. And so Castaño said, so it makes sense that we kill the butchers because we show them that they are forming part of the guerrillas' economy, therefore they are combatants, therefore they are legitimate military targets. That's the kind of reasoning that he uses to justify the unjustifiable, the execution of civilians for really any reason whatsoever. I'd like to just conclude by saying that the application of the laws of war does not depend on the will of any of the parties. It is automatic. It applies whether they like it or not. And I think one of the challenges that the international community, Human Rights Watch among them, has before it is to make this clear to the guerrillas, that we care about human rights. We've made that very clear, but we also care about the laws of war, and we expect them to uphold these standards. Finally, I just want to go over just quickly two more issues that I think are important. One is the issue of landmines, and the other is the issue of the forced recruitment of children. All forces, again, in Colombia use landmines, and we are one of the groups that are calling for all of the forces to stop that and to begin destroying the stockpiles that exist in Colombia. And secondly, the forced recruitment of children is something we're very concerned about. Again, all forces in Colombia forcibly recruit children. The army accepts as recruits 16 and 17-year-old boys. That's kind of the direct way they recruit children. But they also force recruitment by, for instance, if a child who is a guerrilla surrenders or is captured, often that child is kept within military barracks and forced or coerced into working as a guide or patrolling with army units and is often then implicated in joint military-paramilitary operations. For the guerrillas' part, they also use children. Some estimates that we got from our research in Colombia estimated that up to 30% of some guerrilla units are made up of children under the age of 15. And again, the paramilitaries also use children. Again, some of the units, especially in the Middle Magdalena region in Santander, up to 50% of paramilitary units are made up of children under 15.
That was Robin Kirk, researcher on Colombia for Human Rights Watch. That does it for today's show. If you'd like a tape of this program or any other Democracy Now! Show, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill and Maria Carrion. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Michelle Garcia is our web spinner. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Juan Gonzalez with another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!